All right. Let's call the Senate Transportation Committee to order. We'll let the record reflect it is 1:39 p.m. Tuesday, February 22nd. Present today are Senator Machicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Myers. That gives us a quorum to conduct business. Staffing the committee today, as usual, is Nancy Hemingway from Senate Records. Leo is joining us as our moderator today, and Dawson Mann will be my committee aide for the week. Quick reminder, of course, please silence your cell phones if you have them. Today we're going to be revisiting Senate Bill 170, the Marine Highway Corporation, and discussing corporations, authorities, and powers. We will have some future meetings to discuss some other aspects of the Marine Highway Corporation, so I'd like to keep our discussion focused today. I'd like to welcome Teresa Wolstad, my aide, to the table to begin our questions and help deflect to the appropriate authority. We also have Andy Mills in the audience and John Falvey online from the Marine Highway System and Bill Milks from the Department of Law to assist. With that, Ms. Wolstad, if you'd please put yourself on the record and begin.
For the record, my name is Teresa Wolstad, staff to Senator Myers. I will be presenting SB 170, an act related to Alaska Marine Highway Corporation Act. Today we'll be focusing on operations of the public corporation, establishment and organization of the proposed Marine Highway Corporation, powers and authorities of the proposed corporation, and then transitions of the Alaska Marine Highway System from Department of Transportation to a public corporation as housed under the Department of Commerce. So basically, I have several individuals on the line for questions, and we're going to be doing a quick discussion of the bill. So I'd open it up for the committee if there's any particular questions that they'd like to try discussing with SB 170.
All righty. If there's any questions to start us off with. Well, I've got one. So I believe this one's going to go to Mr. Milks, if you're online.
Bill Milks, yes, Chair.
Can you hear me?
On the line. Yes, I can. Can you hear me, Chair?
There we go. Yes, sir. So my initial question for you is, we're asking this new corporation to contract to have a reoccurring contract with the state. And my question for you is there any other corporations that do something similar? And if so, what portion of the state handles the negotiations of that type of contract?
Chairman Bill Milks, Department of Law, that question I will have to think about for a minute. I did try to, per your office's request, sort of review generally public corporations and how they operate in the state. There is certainly ongoing communications between a public corporation and the executive branch and the legislative branch. At times, public corporations do work with executive branch departments. Some of the operational details other folks might know better, but I recall year one of the COVID period, there's the Small Business Relief Program, which was a program that was administered sort of jointly by Department of Commerce and the ADA, Alaska Industrial Development Export Agency. That's an example. I'm sure some of the departments that have corporations with them. I mean, also thinking the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, by statute, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation provides the money investing for that entity. So I'm sure they have different memorandums of agreement and things like that in order to carry out those kinds of tasks. What I'd offer on that question at the moment.
All right, thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a little sort of series of questions in my head about about the notion of the corporation and its contract with the state. I like the idea that certainly from an appropriator standpoint, that the legislature could fund to a certain level of service. But I guess a series of questions about how that works in practical applications, the first of which being that the corporation exists in the executive branch of the state. With whom do they contract? Who's the other signing party?
Mr. Milks, sounds similar to my original question as well.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would agree with you, right? A public corporation, our house in the executive branch. I did not draft this particular bill, but perhaps if someone would want to point to a particular provision on it, I could take a look at it. But again, more generally, it's these interactions between public corporations and executive branch departments. You do have this sort of history of public corporations. Oftentimes there's an initial legislative appropriation made to sort of provide seed money for the public corporation to get going. But I think maybe I'd have to refer that perhaps to the Department of Transportation or others as far as exactly what is envisioned here, how that would work.
Okay. Yes, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I like the concept. But I guess that while, as Mr. Milks suggested, the natural contracting agency for a transportation service would be the Department of Transportation. The DOT commissioner sits on the board, which gives you, I think, a potentially a less than arm's length contract if the DOT commissioner is signing a contract with an agency where he or she is a board member. So that I guess is something that we should probably address with the bill. And then I guess a question maybe best directed to Mr. Milks. There have been times when one legislature has been less than thrilled with a contract signed by a previous legislature, or even potentially the executive branch. Can you talk to us about the subject to appropriation clause that I assume would, well, I guess first question, would this have to be a subject to appropriation contract? And then if so, how does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I guess I apologize, and I'm not the drafter of this bill, so I'm subject to appropriation. I guess I would need a little more explanation as to what we're talking about here. There'll be certain monies that would go from the executive to the public corporation as appropriated by the legislature. Well, if it's subject to appropriation, it is, as you've indicated, subject to appropriation. So if you were going to, and if you were going to appropriate most of these, a lot of these public corporations, like I said, had initial appropriations of seed money to get them going. So that's not an unusual event. And there are sometimes legislature appropriates a significant sum for future years to carry out a program. That's something that also historically has occurred. I think I That would be my best I could do at the moment for your response, Senator Keel, which I'm not sure if I'm fully understanding, but I'm offering you what I can at the moment.
Okay. Senator Keel?
Thank you. And maybe, Mr. Mills, I apologize. This may have been a better sort of question to the sponsor's office and their intent. As I read the bill, it was aimed at a Marine Highway service level, right? And that's going to require annual appropriations of some amount rather than an initial appropriation and then let the corporation go forever. So I guess the questions are how the sponsor intends for that service contract to operate. Does that make sense, or am I spinning off into the ether, Mr. Chair?
Well, that does make sense. I believe the intent was to have the corporation sign that contract with the state, and yes, it is subject to appropriation. It's on page 25, and so there's that backup there, but at the same time, if we've got a contract being negotiated that lowers the amount of lowers the ability of the legislature to somewhat micromanage, you know, add a couple million here, take a million out there, and at the same time also realizing that we're going to have some sort of a subsidy, and this is a restructuring of the subsidy. So the intent of it is to put us at a little bit more arm's length from the appropriation, not from the appropriation process, but from the management processes of it. We want to say this is what we're willing to fund without getting a little bit more into some of the nitty-gritty of how the operations work. If that helps. All right. We do have Terry Bannister from Ledge Legal online. We can bring her on and ask a couple of these questions as well. Ms. Bannister, do you have, can you hear us?
This is Terry Bannister. I presume that I wasn't sure that which section you were looking at. Are you looking at 570 on page 25?
Yes.
Okay. I don't see a problem with public corporation entering into an agreement with another entity, even if it's a state organization. It seems to happen a lot, and there is an exchange of funds sometimes, or memorandums of agreement. In this case, this particular minimum service assurance agreement seems to be, I would say, would be very difficult to enforce. I think it would be difficult to, it's difficult to say what it even means, but I guess we've identified how many sailings, we've identified what it's going to do. But I don't know if the corporation could enforce. I don't see it likely that enforcement would be very easy if the state didn't do that.
Okay. Senator Machicki.
I mean, it would just depend on how accurate the new corporation would try to be on their sailings, right? I mean, if they shot for a one and worked to over-deliver, that's one thing. If they're trying to be accurate, not only is that difficult, but the rates on tickets guaranteed by an assurance agreement, you could have months of extended weather issues that resulted in a loss. You could have, it's just a very unpredictable mode of transportation. If the question is whether or not the agreement is enforceable or something that must be upheld, that's a different question. I think the structure of this section is something we need to look at on making it a more viable agreement in the first place, right? So kind of a side note on the legal question, more of an operational note on does it work, can it work? How do we know I made comments earlier, sailings or other service delivery options, because we don't know what the corporation chooses to do, and there may be legs that end up being a private service provider for some of those legs. Does that meet the intent of the minimum service assurance, or do we get in the way of allowing a corporation to do what they do best and flourish? I have more questions on the operational reality than I do on the legality of the agreement.
Okay. Senator Kiel?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to get deep into the weeds of the legality. Maybe we'll pull back another step and start with this notion. There's going to be a contract for a basic service level. Is the theory, or an assurance agreement, I guess. The legislature will be asked to appropriate to fund that. So maybe just a hypothetical order of events and or order of operations and schedule. Who's going to negotiate this and how far before they come to the legislature? Legislature is going to appropriate something. Who does the renegotiation? When does that all go into effect? Maybe draw me a sort of a flow chart or a picture of how this is going to work on the ground in Alaska once this thing passes.
All righty. For that question, I actually like to ask Mr. Mills to come forward if he might join us. So we've seen some contracts, and you might need to kick this one to Captain Falvey, but We've seen the Marine Highway System Corporation, or the current Marine Highway System, occasionally have to contract out service either because boats down or multiple reasons. And could you walk us through a little bit of some of that contract process and how that works?
Mr. Chairman, Andy Mills, the legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Let me give the basics, and then if there are deeper questions, we'll give that to Captain Falvey. For the current service, the supplemental service that DOT provides, that is currently in the Northern Lynn Canal and some of our what we call the village run areas, in the collective bargaining agreements there is, and I want to say it's 0105, but certainly there's some folks in the back who also know collective bargaining agreements better, where it states an exemption that talks about certain ports that the AMHS can deliver some supplemental service to if needed. And we did an invitation to bid or an ITB to supplement service when there was some layups and ships were out longer during the season, wanted to provide that supplemental service. And also the way that the vessels like the Matanuska and others were in the yard longer than anticipated. That invitation to bid had multiple parties that said that they could take lots of runs. I believe that was Allen Marine and Gold Belt that are supplementing that service. And so, yes, we put out an invitation to bid. Those individuals that could provide for the outline schedule that we put together with procurement staff and AMHS, they bid on those, and we awarded those accordingly. So if it's deeper than that, I certainly will let Captain Falvey add on to that.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. I think one of the questions that we had along those lines was then how that interacts with the state's budget process. You've got the supplemental service you've been talking about, Northern Lynn Canal. We've got the boat down at between Ketchikan and Metlakatla as well, and that's an ongoing one. How that interacts specifically with the budget process. If the contract is completed in, say, let's say December, how that then fits into our budget negotiations here, how much leeway, how much flexibility we end up having, something along those lines. So I'm going to guess we're going to need to kick that to Captain Falvey then.
Mr. Chairman, it's starting to get deeper than my inch and mile wide, so I will kick that to Captain Falvey to supplement.
Yes, Captain Falvey speaking. Mr. Chairman, I would assume that you know, the answer to what you're asking is, and Mr. Mills correctly stated the process for the outsourcing. You know, we call it the outsourcing to the Northern Panhandle Villages and to a little lesser degree at North Lynn Canal. But in this particular year, we are basically doing it to fill gaps that have been created because ships, you know, have been in the shipyards longer, and thus create a situation where we had extra budgeting for that service.
Thank you, sir. So the I think one of the questions we're getting is if I think this probably applies more so to the Ketchikan and Metlakatla run, is how that, since the state isn't providing that service directly, we're outsourcing that. To some extent, we're looking at the same type of relationship here, outsourcing to another corporation, this time state-owned, kind of how that plays into the budget process that goes on here in the legislature and what kind of how that relationship works.
Kevin Talby speaking, Mr. Chairman. Well, right now with the Ketchikan to Metlakatla run, the state ferry, Lituya, does provide that service. And when the Lituya goes out of service, the IFA picks up that run. I mean, that's the way we're doing it now. And it's been happening for quite a few years.
Okay. Oh, all right. I'm sorry. I thought that was my mistake then. I thought the IFA was taking regular runs then. So that's a state-owned ferry and a state-owned group, but then IFA is only there for backup?
Captain Falvey speaking, Mr. Chairman, yes. The IFA backs up that service when the Lituya is in for its annual overhauls. The Lituya this summer, June, July, and August, will be out of commission for a federal-funded capital improvement project, the first one, you know, since the ship was built, and the IFA will fill in behind the Lituya for those 3 months, providing service from Ketchikan to Metlakatla.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ms. Wolstead, did you have something to add there?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Teresa Wolstead. This is actually referring to the Prince of Wales, or the Inter-Island Ferry System, and or the IFA. And that is a private corporation that contracts and provides ferry service from Ketchikan to the Prince of Wales Island.
That was my mistake. Captain Falvey, that was my mistake in referencing the incorrect community. I meant as Ms. Wolstead said, I meant the how the state works with the IFA with regard to the run to Prince of Wales then.
Captain Falvey speaking, through the chair. Senator Wolstead, well, that's a run that is separate to the state. The IFA, maintains, manages, controls that run. That has no bearing at all whatsoever on you know, state, you know, vessel service activities at all. That's the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, and they're a municipal authority.
So the state doesn't supplement them at all?
Mr. Chairman, I believe they do receive some supplemental funding from the state, and I believe it runs through Commerce.
Thank you. Mr. Mills? No? Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. And so that contract then runs, that's negotiated and signed by the Department of Commerce then, you said?
Captain Falvey speaking, Mr. Chairman, I believe the supplemental funding works through the Department of Commerce. That is my understanding for any supplemental funding that they do receive.
Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that's a comparable scenario because the state is not contracting with them to provide a service. The state is providing direct cash assistance that I think they use on, I know they have used for debt service. I believe they have used for extraordinary fuel costs. There may have been a couple of other things. But it's an unrestricted grant to named recipient in the capital budget.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Anybody? Okay. So,
Mr. Chairman, if you're ready for another line of questioning, I can.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's just start in sort of broad strokes terms. The bill, as I read it, gives the new board almost plenary power to dispose of any asset of the Marine Highway System. Sell a ship, sell a terminal, I think get rid of terminal lands, the land terminal sits on. It's broader than I think we give to most state corporations. And maybe, if the sponsor's office could speak to why, that particular approach is proposed.
So the general theory was to try to give the corporation as broad a power as possible, within reason, in order to allow them to make the most efficient use of their resources. And whether that meant leasing something out, they needed to buy a new terminal, lease another piece of property, dispose of a piece of property, dispose of a boat, buy a new boat, whatever might fit the situation best, knowing that right off the bat there probably won't be any significant changes because they're going to have just a hand they're going to have enough time just enough of a hard time just getting the thing up and running. The planning for the future then is going to have to come soon thereafter. But the concept is just to give them as much freedom as possible, and I believe we might be able to ask Mr. Milks to talk about a couple of other corporations that have some similar powers. I would think the railroad and Alaska Aerospace to talk about the powers that they have with regard to buying property, disposing of property, etc. So, Mr. Milks.
Yes, Chairman Bill Milks from the Department of Law. So I think, I haven't studied each individual corporation on that discrete issue, but overall, I think, from your question, Senator Keel, public corporations usually have pretty broad powers, but their powers are created by the legislature. And they couldn't be given powers that are not permitted under the state constitution. So that's sort of it's a lot of policy discretion for the legislature on creating powers for public corporations, but there does run up to a line in which, even a legislature cannot cross. And for example, Mr. Chair, you mentioned Alaska Railroad. Now the Alaska Railroad, there was a case in the Alaska Supreme Court a number of years ago about the Alaska Railroad, about the public notice requirement in the Alaska Constitution in relation to, disposing or leasing state lands. And the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that the legislature could exempt the appropriation from a number of state laws, but not from a constitutional provision. So there's a public notice constitutional provision. So that's sort of the general, generally speaking, the rules of the road. So then a lot of this turns into a policy judgment on how great the powers to provide a public corporation up against the can't be endless. There are certain basic requirements that must be met for establishing a public corporation in order to make that constitutional. I just gave you one example right there.
Thank you. Ms. Wolsett?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, if you refer back to one of the documents I had, which is a quick reference sheet that talks about the different powers and authorities, in addition to that, the legislature can direct a public corporation for caveats on what certain properties they cannot or can lease. One example is the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. For surplus property, what they can actually lease or such, they did put a caveat talking specifically about Poker Flats. So the corporation may not pledge or encumber the Poker Flats research range, which they define as an asset of the University of Alaska. However, the flats may be leased by the corporation and may be leased by the facility space to the university. So in special cases, they actually are allowing and defining certain assets to the corporation and how it can be utilized. And that can be put into the bill itself if you would like to actually stipulate certain assets to be defined that they cannot be surplus or removed. And there are several examples of those, but just one.
Senator Keel?
Oh, thank you. So I guess the first follow-up would be, I know the railroad can lease without coming back, but to sell land, I'm pretty sure the railroad has to come back through the legislature.
Mm-hmm. But they do, through the chair, they do have the authority to come through the legislature to get and grant permission to do so.
So I guess, Mr. Chairman, the question is why so very few sideboards on this corporation as opposed to, say, the railroad corporation? And I guess that my thought would be that certainly the Alaska was cognizant of some of the abuses of railroad corporations and railroads in other states through history, and some of the wheeling and dealing, to put it very gently, that went on with their lands. It I guess raises questions about the future of vessels in the Marine Highway System. And maybe to turn that statement into a question, I'm trying to learn the lessons on the floor today. The vessels of the Marine Highway System are built with and overhauled with federal transportation money, subject to all kinds of federal rules. Isn't there a risk that this corporation is going to get DOT in a lot of trouble with Uncle Sam if it sells a boat the wrong way?
Mr. Mills?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Again, Andy Mills, legislative liaison for the record. That is one of the questions that we would need to look into a bit further when we are talking about MARAD and other entities to which one must go when you are disposing of or doing things with vessels. I certainly can turn it over to Captain Salvi for a more comprehensive list of what those requirements are, but yes, there is an open question we are looking at, because I've had sort of slightly different answers when it comes to federal requirements on assets that were purchased with federal dollars and how a corporation would handle it differently than DOT or be subject to different considerations. So I might toss it to Captain Salvi if he has anything else to add to that.
Captain Falvey?
It's Captain Falvey speaking, Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel. Well, I believe I tend to agree with Mr. Mel that there's still, quite a few questions. Of course, we have a couple different funding sources for our maintenance. One is state capital funding for the annual overhauls that we do to every ship to recertify and re-COI and do, minor to moderate maintenance work. And then the large federal capital improvement projects, which are for the most part federal highways money, not so much FTA money. And, there are rules, of course, for the use of that money. And whether that would differ for a corporate structure as opposed to the state structure that we're under now. I think that will, you know, need further study. Because I just don't know at this point. As far as that federal highways money go, or even federal transit for that matter. But we've tended to not have access to too much federal transit money. Those tend to be grants for transportation in larger urban areas, populations 50,000 or more. We have tried to get some of these FTA grants, but haven't been successful in quite a few years. So federal highways money, it's very formula money, and I think we would have to take a very close look to be sure we still qualify for that as a corporation.
Thank you.
If I may, a tangent more than a follow-up.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question probably best directed to Ms. Wolstead. In that spreadsheet, I don't think there's a check mark on the corporation's ability to obtain a right-of-way or an easement. And I wondered about that a little bit. Obviously, the Coast Guard and the Constitution make it easy to navigate your routes without those. But your docks and your terminals get into upland ownership and tideland ownership and adjacent property owners, and someday you may want to expand a thing. I can think of at least one terminal that we own jointly. Mm-hmm. Reason for excluding that power from the corporation?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So what you're referring to is the exercise of eminent domain with governor approval, or specifically with ability to purchase land for expansion of property systems.
Mr. Chairman, the line in question reads, secure rights of way and easements.
And
it's on your charts on the almost the bottom line.
Yeah. So, through the chair to Senator Keel, there was some discussion of that, and specifically with the Alaska Railroad, with its authority for the right-of-way and easements and such. A lot of that power actually has to do specifically with how the Alaska Railroad was set up actually in a charter under the federal government. So that does give it a lot more power and ability for actually securing of right-of-ways and easements that currently the ferry system does not have because it is not a federal charter. And when the Alaska Railroad was actually purchased and moved over into the state, a lot of those powers were moved over into the state of Alaska. But we still have the federal laws and regulations governing the Alaska State Railroad. So some of those powers can actually impact a federal land, which the Alaska Railroad has ability to work through on federal lands and federal laws. So as I believe I'll have to refer to Andy, the Alaska Marine Highway System does not actually have a charter through the federal government right now to allow them to actually go on federal easements of lands and right-of-ways with federal land.
Through the chair, that is a great question for Captain Salvey. Again, Andy Mills. That's not a question that I've come across in the last 12 months doing this job, so I'll toss that to him. Or I also believe we also have Rob Carpenter on the phone now as well. So
yes.
Captain Salvey might not have it.
All right. So Captain Salvey, we'll start with you.
Mr. Captain Salvey speaking, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Wolstead. I believe you're correct. I've been in this position for 18 years, and I've not come across that particular issue, and I would tend to believe that you're correct, but I'm not positive.
Thank you. Senator Machicki?
So just to go back to Senator Keel's question, and Captain, this might be one that you touch. I mean, the corporation decides we need another terminal somewhere, and or to expand a terminal somewhere, there's an alternative source of power. Utility may not have a right-of-way right for that particular piece. If the Marine Highway Corporation also does not have the ability to create or secure their own right-of-way or easement, isn't that potentially difficult? So we're trying to look forward on what this system could look like 25 years from now. We don't change things very often here. Is that not potentially a gap?
Captain Falvey, through the chair, I believe Senator Keel. I think I would start to try to answer that question, you know, by saying we have 36 ports of call. The state owns 13 terminals. The remainder of those terminals that we call at are all per agreement, MOUs, agreements with privately owned facilities, cities, municipalities, things of that sort. So that's how we visit 36 ports, only owning 13 of them.
So
it's two separate agreements.
Thank you, Captain. So kind of to expand on that, if the Marine Highway System currently wanted to expand to another port of call, you'd be more likely to enter into an agreement with a municipality to use their facilities rather than to have the Marine Highway System purchase or lease a facility. Is that correct?
Captain speaking, Mr. Chairman, yes. Yes, that would be correct. That would be the most direct way to accomplish that. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thanks for answering the question for him, but that doesn't solve the problem. It theoretically solves the problem, but we don't know that it solves it in the long run. And I'm just wondering why we wouldn't give them that authority to secure. I mean, if you're worried about eminent domain, you have a separate section for that we could clarify in the bill. But it's a pretty typical authority for someone that's going to become an independent state corporation, I would think.
I'm going to go through here.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't need answers today. We're asking things that might take a little additional research, and that's fine. We're not in a hurry for answers. So I think these are questions that could go on the record, and then perhaps they can provide more detailed answers later.
Understood.
Your staff has their hand
up. Oh, sorry. Ms. Wolstead.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, on page 23 of the bill, we do have a section with acquisition of property, public use of corporational land, and then exchange of land, and then looking at prescriptive easements and such. So very similar to like other public corporations, we do give them the authority to actually go and own property in the name of the corporation itself, and they can actually be able to control the property as a state agency, and be able to actually work with an additional corporation. In addition, we also worked with them, the proposed corporation, to own, buy, or locate in another state or foreign country. So that particular clause also allows us to work with Canada for ports and such around in the Canada area, but also in Seattle and other areas around in Washington state. So it allows them to have adjustable flexibility for port expansion as well.
Thank you for that, staff. But it really doesn't answer the question. You're going to have to depend on something existing that is fit for purpose, and that may not be what the future looks like. So my only concern, I have another area of questions, if you don't mind, on that.
Sure.
On just wondering why we selected the bonding options that we did when it takes required legislative approval for Alaska Aerospace, ADA, and Alaska Railroad. In fact, the only public corporation that you have on your list that doesn't require approval for bonding is Alaska Housing, which I think it's pretty obvious why. But this is more like the others, certainly more like the railroad. And that's generally a pretty simple process. It's kind of a just check and balance that you're not expanding debt to the point, even though we are not liable directly as a state, and you certainly want to, it's never heard of a bill right now on a railroad bond request. It just gives us a chance to review it and understand where they're going and where that money's going to be spent, and probably some of the details about the potential bond. But just wondering why we didn't do the same for the In fact, we have issue bonds independently without limits and without any legislative approval, which seems pretty broad.
Well, again, and perhaps Ms. Wolstead can expand on this a little bit, but again, the concept was to try to make their powers as broad as possible. If the legislature wanted to rein some of those in, with the way that this bill is constructed, I think we'd be somewhat open to that. We felt it would be easier to start broad and rein it in a little bit later if necessary, rather than hamstring them out of the gate. It was the general policy call on that one. Ms. Wolstead, I don't know if you had anything to add to that or not.
Through the chair, again, for the record, this is Teresa Wolstead. We do have the ability for the fidelity bonds, and that's on page 23 of the bill there. And that's allowing them to actually go through the board itself. So then the limitations and the direction through each executive officer would allow for the responsibility of the accounts and finances. And thus it's more focusing with the board authority for issuing the bonds.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chickie, did you have any?
No, that's how I understood it.
Okay.
Issuing bonds without a second set of eyes is primarily my concern, but that's okay. That answers my question. Thank you.
Understood. All right. Senator Keel.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. I shared kind of the same question that Senator Machicki had about that, as well as the ability, I think, to pledge just about any asset of the corporation against those bonds. I guess that you know, again, raised the same thought about maybe another set of eyeballs on it. And I'm trying to remember, is there any limitation to the bonds of the corporation, or is it just whatever Wall Street will lend you? In terms of dollar amounts or percentage of revenues, percentage of asset values.
Ms. Wolstead, I'm not sure if it's going to be you or if we need to ask Mr. Milks that question.
I believe if you can direct to Mr. Milks real quick, I will verify real quick.
Mr. Milks, I believe the question is what sort of limitations on there on bonding is there besides what specifically might be mentioned in this bill, if the legislature specifically limits the bonding authority of this corporation?
Yes, Chairman, I'm just taking a quick look for this particular bill, but looks like it's Article 7. The proposed AS-4250. I'll take a look at that. But the, you know, bonding is sort of the, if you look at Alaska's public corporation, that's the authority that goes back to the earliest corporations, which were the predecessor to Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Senator Chickie, I believe it was, sort of identified the nature of what they do and why maybe the legislature's been very, not hands-on on their bonding authority. But basically, the only place you see public corporations in the Alaska Constitution is in the section about bonds, Article 9, Section 11, that there's public corporations that can issue revenue bonds. And so the early cases were revenue bonds for housing, the predecessor HFC, and a predecessor corporation of ADA, revenue bonds for industrial development. Concept is that corporations would pay back the debt service through the revenues, and the state would be protected if not responsible for the bond through repayment. And I'm not sure if your aide's ready to speak specifically to this bill about the bond limitations. I'm inferring from the question that there are not the type of restrictions on amount of bonds that exist in some of the other public corporations. That's another policy call, I think, for the legislature to make.
Thank you, Mr. Mooks. Ms. Volstead?
Looking over the bill, I do not see a number specifically for limiting a notch to bonding. So that is always an option that we can actually address and discuss. I know there are limits for discussion for bonding and going through the board, but I do not believe there's any authority within the bill that establishes they cannot bond up to a certain level or have it approved by, say, the governor or the legislature at that time frame. So we could go through and address that and follow some of the other corporations and examples of that, too. It is a little more open based on that. And we do have Terry Bannister, if you'd like, to discuss that openly.
Okay. Thanks. To the last question I had prepared on the bond question was sort of a comparison with the railroad. The railroad, we have a section in statute that says the bonds are a sort of a public purpose. I think it's the bonds of the railroad corporation are for an essential public and governmental purpose. And I note that there isn't a comparable section here. Can you talk about what purpose that section serves for the railroad, or we may have to send somebody from the railroad to get back to us, but why that wasn't included here? What's the difference?
So while we didn't have that, as Ms. Paul said, looking well, we didn't have that provision listed specifically with the bonds. We did have it. We did have in the findings at the beginning of the bill that we find that the Marine Highway System Corporation is an essential function, and so it's an essential part of the state transportation system, warrants continued and predictable state support, and so that's sort of the overall attitude of the bill, that this is an essential government function, but it just didn't put it specifically into that section. Ms. Volstead, if you had anything to add?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, looking over a little bit of the brief powers and statutory authorities, I have description for the Alaska Railroad. I apologize ahead of time. My knowledge on the railroad is a little bit limited on that. But for bonding with approval, a lot of the... a lot of the bonding with the railroad is actually based upon approval of the legislature and provided for securement of the payment for that. The rights of the holders and to hold and dispose in the purchase of the corporation bonds are at a price that are no more than the principal amount of them plus the interest, and the cancel of the bonds of the corporation has been purchased. So the securement and payment of the bonds and the pledge and mortgages and liens as its assets for the corporation itself. I could probably go in and get more information directly from the railroad for more details of how they set up their bonding approval, and I will get back to you on that. But that is, as far as I can read right now, with the Alaska Railroad bond approval rating with the legislature.
Okay. We can follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. All right. Other one. All right, Senator Keel.
Outside of bonding, if we're ready to move on.
Please, yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that this corporation is authorized in the bill to create subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated the chart your office provided that showed that AHFC and ADA can do that. Of course, they engage in project financing frequently with private developers and with ownership of specific individual projects in various places around the state. They don't directly provide generally service or operate a system. Aerospace and the railroad kind of do, and they don't have that subsidiary power. I'm curious. I maybe just be having a lack of vision here. What would we foresee the Marine Highway System Corp needing subsidiaries to do?
So one thought that we did have that they may go the direction of is sometimes we have we notice that there's Southeast operates one way sometimes, and we've also got then the South Central and Southwest portions, and there was a consideration that that might be one way that they might set up a subsidiary corporation to operate those separately as one possibility. Certainly we weren't trying to tell the new corporation that's what they have to do, but that was one thing that ran through our minds as a possibility. Again, wanted to put out as broad a power as possible, and if we chose to rein that in, then we could do that. But that was the initial policy call as well. Mr. Wolfstead, do you have anything to add?
Through the chair, I believe that was the intent. The idea was actually to make a little more of the ability to work and be functional for what works for Southeast Alaska does not necessarily work and apply to Southeast or South Central. By having the subsidiary, there was an option for the corporation to try to more custom fit certain areas of the state of Alaska. So it was one option that we had through the chair.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just to clarify, the vision there would be to have an Alaska Marine Highway System Corporation, the Southwest Alaska Marine Highway System Corporation, the Prince William Sound Ferry Co., all under this umbrella, is that?
That would be one possibility, yes.
It strikes me that the rest of the bill gives significant power and opportunity for the corporation to partner with a local port authority that might come into being if, I don't know, if the Prince William Sound communities wanted to go that route and partner up with the Marine Highway System Co. To contract with a municipality I know is explicitly in the bill. It's an interesting dynamic that we might consider both those things, that breadth of authority and subsidiaries as well. It, I guess, leads to the question, are there is the bill written tightly enough that what strictures we do have for the corporation apply fully to the subsidiaries? And I don't know which of the lawyers in the online might be best to address that.
Okay. I believe we'll start with Mr. Milks, and then we'll go to Ms. Bannister on that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Senator Keel, on the subsidiary issue, I think you might have identified early on where it's more common to see subsidiaries for public corporations, which are the entities like ADA, AAA, AGDC, that are involved in project financing, and so there's could be some good business reasons to have a create a subsidiary that's on the Marine Highway Transportation. I think that might be one that you'd want to study carefully. What language we're using on the, if you're going to have subsidiaries, and sort of study that, compare it with our other public corporations, and then also, more generally, I think it's just a kind of public transportation entity. Our only model right now is Alaska Railroad within Alaska, but it's certainly not unusual in other states to have some kind of transportation entity created with another through something other than a straight executive branch department. And so maybe we benefit by looking at those entities, see if they do create subsidiaries, what sort of language they use that needs to be tightened up or not. I guess that's certainly a good question. That's what I would probably do if I was going to study that issue a little more.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. Ms. Bannister, did you have anything to add?
This is Terry Bannister. I would just say that you may want to make it clearer what their powers could be, but I can't. I think that the basic corporation can't give a subsidiary corporation any more powers than it has. It's totally owned by that corporation, the main corporation. So I don't think they could go beyond what the main Marine Highway Corporation can do.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Bannister. That's helpful. I guess it does lead me to think a little bit about the potential for balkanization, right? We have a $120 million Hubbard, and she's going to get a $15 or $18 million set of crew quarters on her. Could she end up owned by, you know, a port authority in Valdez, Cordova, to run Prince William Sound, and everything we put into making her a flexible vessel, interoperable with most ports in the system. I don't want to say it's wasted, but now she's an asset of the Valdez, Cordova Corp. That'd be the Valcoco. Never mind. So I should noodle on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Keel. Otherwise,
Mr. Mills may.
Oh, Mr. Mills, yep, sorry.
For the record, Andy Mills, DOT. I just wanted to make sure, did I hear $120 million for the Hubbard? Because it was the Hubbard and the Tasmania that I think added up to that amount, just to be, my ears were listening.
Mr. Chairman, I stand corrected. That was, I misspoke. Thank you.
Okay. All righty. With that, did you have any other lines of questioning to run through?
Mr. Chairman, on broad spectrum powers of the corporation, I think those were my primary lines of inquiry. The big bill has plenty of other questions in it, but I think that was our agenda. If that was our agenda for the day, if I understood that right.
Correct. That was the plan. So, all righty. Well, with no other questions, and well, it looks like we're going to end a little bit early today, but that's fine. We are going to let me go back here. So we're going to be holding SB 170 and revisiting it at another time. Our next meeting is going to be Thursday, February 24th, where we're going to be setting this bill aside for a bit. We're going to be doing our confirmation hearings for the Board of Marine Pilots appointees and for our new Department of Transportation Commissioner appointee. And with that, we are going to be adjourned at 2:42 p.m. Thank you.
Your host is exiting the conference.